You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
you gonna do?
Do you really think that?
Do you think it all?
Yeah. I never meant cares about you.
Ain't giving up a second thought about you. No. Get to people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell me.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God, for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement: Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Hotep family, hope everything is well for you today. It is a beautiful day. It is the birthday of the Honorable Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. So it's a special day, and that's the focus of our program for the day. But for you, I hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, need, do, should do, must do, can, and do, will do. And I hope that the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But if it isn't, I know you'll get it done anyway, because the kind of brother and sister that you is, you always persevere. And that's why we appreciate you and we respect you and we love you for it. So keep on keeping on. Ashe. This is African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, and any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. When you get on the page, look for podcast, click on that, and you'll see African Perspectives. Right at the top, click on that, and then there will be programs that are dated and titled. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media on Mondays, as I stated, we're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then Monday evening at 6 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, public affairs programming with Brother Wahad. Right after that is Let's Buy Black 365 at 8 to 9. And then after that is Conversation Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey from 9 to 10. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. Great show last night, Doc Rogers, Brother LaRue Ned, and why we should not call our ancestors slaves. Yeah, I can't for the life of me understand why people, because I understand it. I'm just maybe being facetious, but we're so conditioned. So great program last night, Doc Rogers. Every Tuesday night, Black Reality Think Tank from 8 to 10. On tonight, Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC, Proof of Consciousness from 8 to 10. And on Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy at 7 p.m. Relationships with Joy and Troy. If it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, that's right. It is Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Fridays at 8 p.m. Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Right, you know it. What? Let me go back to Friday. I apologize to Sister Marcy, although she will not be broadcasting this weekend, this Friday, but her program is every Friday from 1 p.m. till 2. The Esoteric Review with Marcy Lee on Fridays. And then on Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., it is not me, it's Sister POC. Her program, Revive, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sunday. And then Sunday evening at 7 p.m., it's Time for an Awakening, once again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Monday through Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m., The Warren Ballantyne Show, right here on Time for an Awakening Media. And, of course, the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. WeBuyBlack.com. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses at WeBuyBlack.com. It is the largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses. Is WeBuyBlack.com, and the products that are produced are sold. Or the products that are sold are produced by us. When you go online, you notice that they are making the plea to support the development of a supermarket here in the Atlanta area. As I stated the other day, I would hope that we can all come together as African people here in this country and say we're going to all support that idea, putting some money, I would say we should do it with Ulu, not because I'm a member of Ulu, but we already have what we need. Just do it. We Buy Black could join in that. All other churches, everybody could join into that. We would have the money. The reason why our cafe did not succeed is because the people who put money into Ulu did not really believe it. I'm going to just be real. We didn't support it. And mainly the people here in Atlanta. I don't expect somebody from Chicago to drive down here to get a damn cup of coffee. But I do expect somebody from Chicago or anywhere else to go online and buy something and pay your dues and seek to get a share. Support this concept. I'm hoping that somebody from We Buy Black will be at our meeting in March. And let's develop a plan to make a supermarket, not just in Atlanta, but every major metropolitan area where a good sizable number of our people are, so we have a viable alternative for our food buying choices. Okay. Africa for the Africans. Africa for the Africans. Oh, by the way, of course, I'll say this again. I forgot to say this, but if you are in the Atlanta area, and you're near the Greenbrier Mall, they have a kiosk in the Greenbrier Mall. The Greenbrier Mall is located right off of Georgia Highway 166 going towards 285, right? We're 285 and 166, so the Greenbrier Mall. So, okay. Africa for the Africans. Brother Bomani is back. I went online. He has a lot of good programs. Let me just go back online to Africa for the Africans right quick to tell you what the brother has in store, you know, because what he has in store is really great and beautiful. It really is. So I'm going to try to. Let me see. Where am I going with this? Okay, you're right. I should have did this.
This call is being recorded.
I should have did this earlier. Okay, we got it right here. Let's see, we have a caller. Caller 646. Caller 646. Good afternoon.
Nah, it's morning, Oshie. It's morning.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is morning, isn't it? Yeah, okay. Let me
good
get it
morning. Hey, listen, Oshie, did I just hear you right? The coffee shop closed down?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Last year, October.
Well, I didn't know that. I thought the coffee shop was still open.
No, it's not. We had to close it. We were not being supported. We were not being supported by our members, particularly here in Atlanta, and actually across the board, because they weren't going to the website and buying coffee or any other thing that the T-shirts, sweatshirts that we had to offer, whatever it was, and nor did they pay their dues. They did not pay their dues. We have a mechanism of informing you when your dues is up each year, based upon when you came into. I mean, there's over almost 600 members of Us Lifting Us. 600 members. And if all of them had paid their dues, which is $50 a year. But more importantly, if they took out a share, which or a unit, which is $1,000, and which they could pay for that, you know, over a period of time, in conjunction with paying your dues, like I have been doing. Like I bought the car. Man, you know, when I go into something, brother, I'm dedicated. I'm just that kind of brother. I'm just that kind of man. You know, I'm a man of my word. I'm dedicated. I see the vision. I understand the concept of Us Lifting Us. And
so is Us Lifting Us still in existence?
Oh, of course it is. Oh, yes. Definitely. We have a conference coming up. Oh, yeah. Us Lifting Us is still what's happening. It's just that, you know, we had to just take a step back. We had to resolve and dissolve the Cafe Ulu. We had to.
And you know what's so crazy, Oshie, is that the same people that won't go and purchase from Cafe Ulu will take their money
Starbucks.
And get their black behind.
That's right.
The Starbucks and yep. McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts
yep.
every damn day.
Yep. And you're right again, dear brother.
And if I'm not mistaken, did y'all have a pretty good brand of coffee?
Yes, we did. Yes, Jay, you are right again, my dear brother, because we had one, I think I considered one of the best, which is Cameroon Boyo. Because, I mean, I drink coffee black. You know, if you want to drink coffee black.
Yeah, I don't drink coffee, I don't.
Okay, cool. That's cool. You know, but hey, we have some real good teas from a vendor here in the Atlanta area, man. His hibiscus ginger tea was just simply off the chain. And these were loose teas, and we had a cup where, you know, we could pour the hot water in, pour the loose tea in there, let it steep and so forth. And the tap of the cup was like a little foam where you don't get all the particles from the tea. You just get the juice. You just get the tea. You know, oh, it's fantastic. We had it. I mean, we had it going on. I mean, could we have done some different things? Of course we could have. You know, had a better variety menu, of course we could have. But the bottom line is we're trying to grow a business. And we're trying to grow a business collectively. You know, when I see other businesses that are individual are still standing and doing well, and I say, here we have a co-op. What that means is that when you put your money into it, you're a part of it. Support it. So
I know.
Go ahead, Jay.
Me and the Queen was going somewhere. This was like maybe 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And where we was going, they had a drive-in Starbucks.
Okay.
And you know how you are in the world. You know you just doing something. She said to me, babe, could you pull over and get me a coffee? I said, okay. Now, I've never really been and the coffee, so I never paid the prices of Starbucks in Iman. The only time I would ever go there is maybe to use the bathroom, and I still didn't pay it no mind. Well, let me tell you something, Ophie. I drove up to the what's it called, and I saw the prices.
And yeah. Yeah.
I ordered the coffee, and she had the nerve to say, would you pay for it?
Yeah.
You know what I did. You know what I did. I just drove past the window.
You just kept on driving, huh?
For 2 hours.
Hey.
I mean, she really went off. She went off for 2 hours. And I sat there listening to Stevie Wonder for 2 hours, listening to the madness. I said, ain't no way God's green earth. I'm giving somebody $6-7
for a cup of coffee.
I think it was $5 at that time. $5-6 for a coffee.
Yeah, well, all those flavored coffees, those lattes, cappuccinos, and mochas, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so coffee.
If you went into your purse or in your pocket and gave me the money, I'd have stopped there and you'd have had it. But if you thought that I was going to that type of money for me, but you know better.
All right, Jay.
Well, in 2 hours on Cornell.
And it was in a system, I say, deservingly so. But listen, bro, let me finish doing these announcements and get it to my program. No. I'm going to do Dr. King. It's Dr. King's birthday, so I'm going to pay tribute to Dr. King from a more African-centered perspective. Talk about Dr. King.
All right, cool.
All right, dear brother. Thanks, Jay.
Put me on mute.
All right, got you. Peace. Oh, man, I tell you, Lord. My good brother Jay. Yeah, getting back to Brother Bomani Tahemba in African for Africans, and believe me, give him a call. AfricansForTheAfricans.org. Go online yourself. See what I'm talking about. Okay? Then phone number is 404-931-9429. 404-931-9429. And what's coming up is Senegal and Gambia, April 3rd through the 13th for $3,300. Right after that, the Ghana Repatriation and Investment Tour, May 25th through June 5th for $3,700. Right after that, African Roots and Culture Tour, November 20th through the 30th for $3,700. And then ending the year with, once again, a Ghana. He has four trips, the Ghana Repatriation Tour. And once again, that is $3,700. All these are very affordable. You have Senegal and the Gambian Roots Tour, April 3rd through the 13th, $3,300. The Repatriation and Investment Tour to Ghana, May 25th to June 5th, that is $3,700. Then you have African Roots and Culture Tour, November 20th through the 30th, for $3,700. And then that is, so you have a lot to choose from. And here's a special note. You can pay using your easy payment, free payment plan, limited space available, and pay only $400 deposit to reserve your trip. $400 deposit. And then pay on the plan as you go on. Now, of course, there's also Dr. Renoka Rashidi, my good brother, Dr. Renoka Rashidi, in his tour. He is going to Senegal next week, the 21st. He's going to Senegal, Gambia, and Guinea-Bissau. He's already there. Not there, but where's he at? He's not in the States. But he has a trip to Senegal, Gambia, and Guinea-Bissau. In Senegal, it was added that you can visit the radiocarbon dating laboratory established by that great, honored historian and scholar, Dr. Cheikh Anta Diop. That's going to be something special. Then, of course, you're going to Gambia, the Welcome to Jufare, the Kembe Belongo, Kunta Kinte. And, of course, Guinea-Bissau. And then, of course, he has a trip to Uganda and Rwanda coming up. Now, the trip that I just mentioned, the three places, that was $3,800. Now, this is $4,200. But you're going to go to Uganda and Rwanda. And that is going to be from the 5th of October to October 16th. 11-day, 10-day tour. So, once again, contact Brother Renoko at drrenoko.com. Dr. Renoko. Just go online. Look at the photos of that trip. It's beautiful. I'm talking about Rwanda, Uganda. Just beautiful, man. Rwanda. Now, I know you just heard about what's happening with Rwanda. So, once again, these are the tours. Hope you will be able to participate. Shrine of the Black Madonna. Shrine of the Black Madonna, located in the West End here in Atlanta. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 12 to 7 and Sunday from 1 to 3. And, of course, Shrine of Black Madonna's got it all. They got furniture. They got clothing. They got artwork. They got all kinds of good stuff. And, they have books. If you're looking for a book and they don't have it, they'll get it for you. Believe me, they will. They've done it for me. Also, too, they have the red, black, and green shoes and the gas shoes. Okay? They also have an African Holocaust Museum. They have a class every Saturday, African history class of Know Thyself, every Saturday, free and open to the public, 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. Brother Olatunje, outstanding job. And of course they have, if you can't make those classes, but you want that information, they have a multimedia library, the African History Club. They have a multimedia library with over 7 terabytes, 7 terabytes. The one I got is and it's big too, you know, 4.5. So that's 2.5 more terabytes than what I got. So I got to get it. Got to have that information. Shrine of the Black Madonna, located in the West End. And the number to call to the shrine, brothers and sisters, is 404-549-8676. 404-549-8676. The Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall, right next to the kiosk of We Buy Black. If you're at the kiosk of We Buy Black, if you turn right or you turn left, you'll see the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall. And they have the finest selection of books, postcards, greeting cards, t-shirts, all kinds of good stuff. Open Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 9, Sunday from 12 to 6. And the number to call for the Medu Bookstore to see if they have the book that you're requesting or the book that they don't have it, believe me, they'll get it for you. And the number is 404-346-3263. 404-346-3263. My good brother, Gazende Ajamu, the proprietor of the Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore in Lithonia. There is light in the Black Dot, brothers and sisters. Trust me. Believe it. And give him a call. He has books, t-shirts. He also has the shoes, the red, black, and green shoes. They're in Lithonia. 404-519-8107. 404-519-8107. Us lifting us, the economic development cooperative for our people in the spirit of Ujamaa, cooperative economics, or as we like to say, family-centered economics. Their Thursday night broadcast tomorrow night on Blog Talk Radio at every Thursday night at 9 p.m. from 9 to 10. Just 1 hour to give it a listen. And more importantly, sign up. Go to the website, usliftingus.com. To listen to the broadcast tomorrow night is 929-477-2789. 929-477-2789. Us lifting us to economic development cooperative for our people in the spirit of Ujamaa cooperative economics. The relationship 101 for brothers and sisters. For brothers only, the lecture will be given by Brother Baruti, Baba Baruti. The workshop will be Saturday, February 1st at 10 a.m. from 10 to 12. That workshop will be followed by Relationships 101 for sisters only. And that lecture will be given by Sister Yaba Rudy. And of course, that follows the Saturday, also on Saturday, the 1st. I got to get the particulars. I thought I had them. I was looking for them, and I couldn't find them. I'll get them. You know me. Akabin Institute. Baba Baruti and Sister Yaba Rudy have been doing an outstanding job of educating our young people, our young warriors. You know that this education is sincere and dedicated and committed to liberating African people. It must be supported by us. We cannot and it will not accept outside donors, strictly us. Akabin Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. Make your checks out to checks and money order out to Akabin Institute. Mail it to P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. If you want to deal with PayPal and Cash App, put in the dollar sign, YAYAA, the letter M, and then Baruti, B-A-R-U-T-I, and you can support Akabin Institute. Brothers and sisters, you should go online and go to the website of sanjay-haiti.org. Sister Gabrielle, Sister Gabby doing outstanding work in the northeastern portion of the island of Haiti in the rural area with those young people. Just beautiful work that definitely needs to be supported. sonjay-aayiti.org. Sanjay-Haiti.org, dealing with education, health, and growing food and so forth, sustainability, self-sustainability. Black Talk Radio Network, Black Talk Radio Network Project, the Media Fund. So go to Black Talk Radio Network, TBTRN.com, Black Talk Radio Network, and donate to the Radio Media Project. The Inye Sesem of Daily Revolutionary thought. January 14th. Revolutions are never compromising. Revolutions are never based on negotiations. Revolutions are never based upon any kind of tokenism whatsoever. Brother Omar Wally, El Haj Malik El Shabazz, Malcolm X. Some Africans believe they can establish a separate peaceful space within European dominated territory. And we do. That's what I'm saying, brothers. We cannot. We cannot. There is. It is plain and simple from the, when the Europeans came out of those caves and the Europeans came out of that dark age, there is no way in hell that anybody else on this planet can peacefully coexist with Europeans. Some Africans believe that we can establish a separate peaceful space within European-dominated territory. They wrongly believe a deed or a treaty and their timely mortgage and tax payments will ensure that Europeans will allow them to exist in peace. They wrongly expect that Europeans will respect their earnest efforts as good, law-abiding citizens to purchase land so they can grow their own crops, develop their own resources for themselves, and become more spiritually connected in peace with no possible threat of invasion. For some strange reason, they believe that the European has changed, blindly holding on to hope and a non-existent morality. They forget what these people have done every time they wanted something that they did not belong to them. They forget that a land people, they forget that landed people unable to defend and keep their land is still a powerless people. We forget that a landed people unable to defend and keep their land is still a powerless people. Affirm, the land I claim will not be taken. Affirm, the land I claim will not be taken. And the only land that we can claim that will not be taken is on the soil of the continent. January 15th. The enemy can never be driven out by words alone, no matter how sound the argument. A kind proverb. Westerners or other people who think like them seek to gather information, but not in the random or open fashion as they would have us believe. Instead, they methodically shift through statements of those ideas that support their beliefs. For example, they do not attend forums, debates, or lectures about political, cultural issues to have their minds changed unless they were dissatisfied with their position beforehand. A broadened or contrary perspective is sought only when they have no other choice because they have become overpowered and have a need to pretend an exclusive multiculturalism, or because they realize that what they believe has completely failed them. But even then, they acquiesce only with the expectations that this new truth will eventually be brought in line with their unchanged agenda to be credited to them as their original thinking. Debate is never for the sake of debate, except to distract their enemies. They attend public discussions in order to have what they have already believed validated by experts. They attend to receive information that fits what they already know. Affirm, I engage in thought and action which produces concrete results. Affirm, I engage in thought and action which produces concrete results. The Inye Sesim of daily revolutionary thought. Today is the 15th. Today is Dr. King's birthday. Born this day in 1929. Yeah, 1929. A couple of years after my mother was born. And what a great man. And I know for all those who were living at the time, just like all other historic horrific events, you remember where you were when the event happened or when you found out about the event. When you found out about the event, I remember. I had been, man, I've been playing ball, man. I had no idea Dr. King had got shot until I came down, until I came home. You know, I don't, whatever time school let out, I was playing ball up until like 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. And I came home and my mother came downstairs and she was crying. You know, Mom, what's up? They killed Dr. King. I was like, whoa, man. And which is ironic because it was that time of the upheaval and so forth that was happening across the country. And of course, that new wave of radicalism, which I was more embracing than the belief in civil rights. And that was interesting because, you know, I was more in line with Malcolm, even though, and I remember when he died, when I heard about that, I was in the car with my mother and my auntie from Chicago. And in the afternoon, it came around like early evening, like 4 or 5, you know, on the news that he was assassinated in New York City. And, because it was around that time that me and my brother started to box. And of course, Muhammad Ali had joined the nation. And, wow. Just like all the other incidents that, you know, JFK, remember that? I mean, all of those things that happened, you know, 9/11, when those things happened, you remember where you were when they happened and what you were doing or where you were at and so forth. Because there were tremendous, unfortunate, sad historic events. This comes out of Atlanta Black Star and Dr. King, the other side of a complex leader. And this is, this is old, 2013. And this is Nathan McCall. Nathan McCall is the author of the book Makes You Want to Holler. That's a book I have, A Young Black Man in America. It's decent reading. He serves as award-winning reporter for several newspapers, including the Washington Post. McCall is a senior lecturer in the Department of African Studies at Emory. I didn't know he was here in Atlanta. He's at Emory. And he also has written 2 other books, What's Going On, and a novel titled Them. So this is part of Nathan McCall. We have entered the time again when the nation ponders the life and words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It is a period of King's birth, and I wonder which version of the man will dominate our thinking. Will we bite into the rough, tough ideas posed by the hardcore warrior who was among America's greatest critics? Or will we nibble contently on the peaceful candy apple accounts of King? The candy apple version is sweet and harmless. He is the preacher who espoused universal brotherhood. Remember? At a time, when segregationists routinely attacked American Africans nationwide, he promoted the Christian virtue of pacifism. The Candy Apple King is the fellow known most for standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963 and thunderously declaring, "I have a dream." Aside from the famous, aside from the most extreme races, most Americans adored that speech. They especially loved the part where he expressed a yearning for the day when American African and Caucasian children will hold hands together. The Candy Apple King, the version most often taught in schools, is watered down and syrupy. Sure, the I Have a Dream speech was a moving, brilliant piece of oratory, but taken in isolation, it transforms Dr. King into Dr. Feelgood. The I Have a Dream speech alone reflects only a slither of King's expansive thinking. I have seen other speeches and writings that reveal more strident and radical aspects of the civil rights leaders. Imagine. In fact, in today's parlance, King might even be labeled an angry American African man. The hardcore King used to upset lots of folks with his stinging critiques on issues related to class. He was especially obsessed with protecting poor people from the crushing greed of America's wealthy class. In fact, when he was slain in 1968, he had gone to Memphis to campaign on behalf of the garbage workers. The poor can stop being poor, he once opined. The poor can stop being poor if the rich are willing to become even richer at a slower rate. Can you imagine? Nowadays, all we hear about from, well, of course, Obama was president at that time. All we hear about from Obama on down is the need to rescue the middle class. And the same thing that Trump came in campaigning on, but sure in the hell didn't even think about doing. Because the rich kept getting richer. I'll save that piece of commentary later. The hardcore King also expressed strong views about race in blunt terms that are seldom quoted in public accommodationists. He delivered withering attacks on racism in America that still resonate today. He said, Caucasians, it must be frankly said, are not putting forth similar mass effort to re-educate themselves out of their racial ignorance. It is an aspect of their sense of superiority that the Caucasian people of America believe they have so little to learn. Conservatives today will find the mild-mannered Obama tough to stomach, would refuse the hardcore King, and well, would confuse the hardcore King with Malcolm X. The hardcore King unleashed frontal attacks on the stubborn resistance to full equality for everyone. Caucasian America is not even psychologically organized to close the inequality gap. They are not. He said, essentially, it seeks to make it less painful and less obvious, but in most aspects to retain inequality. Most of the abrasions between American Africans and Caucasian liberals arise from this fact. They want to maintain their position of superiority, of dominance and control. Apathetic American Africans didn't escape King's tongue lashing either. He was especially tough on those American Africans who smugly deemed themselves middle class. He accused many so-called middle class American Africans of shirking their obligation to reach back and help their struggling brothers and sisters. I know there are many people who take this occasion very seriously. They use this time to reflect on where we have been, how far we must go, and how they can contribute to that effort. Those are the right-minded people. I'll repeat, this is what the right-minded people are doing as they reflect on what Dr. King was about and what our situation is. They know there are many people who take this occasion seriously. They use this time to reflect on where we have been, how far we must go, and how can they contribute to that effort. But I also believe this. If he were alive, the hardcore King might have a tough time finding an audience in today's America where unfiltered capitalism rules. After all, King promoted the need to restructure the entire capitalist system. In fact, he flirted with socialism, which is widely regarded as a cuss word today. You saw that with Trump at that couple of rallies where he was shooting down this idea. And many people at that rally are Poe as hell. And the only way that they would not be Poe is if they had a socialistic structure that made sure that all people had, and not just a small percentage that had so much and be so damn greedy. Sure, we will hold King celebrations and recite the I Have a Dream speech in infinity. My money says we'll be most likely ingesting sweets this month. The real sadness is that many young people in particular will not get exposed to the hardcore King. Yeah, we'll probably be having sweets, and you always do that. This is a speech by Dr. King. This is the Why I Oppose the Vietnam War.
The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. Now, I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty. Against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom, there has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silenced. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. So this morning I speak to you on this issue, because I am determined to take the gospel seriously. There is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam. And I watched the program broken as if it were some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. And you may not know it, my friends, but it is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportion relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery. I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement. We nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Bull Connor." There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward Jim Clark," but will curse and damn you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children." There's something wrong with that press. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cries. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told. And all the while, the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. This is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investment. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, when machines and computers' profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people. The giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And it is a sad fact that because of comfort complacency, a morbid fear of communism, our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. A genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This calls for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation. Is in reality a call for an all-embracing, unconditional love for all men. This oft misunderstood and misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly force, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of mankind. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against this war, not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away, and this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow, may be too late. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. Now, it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated when you tell the truth and take a stand. Sometimes it means losing a job. It means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7 or 8 year old child asking your daddy, why do you have to go to jail so much? I've long since learned that to be a follower of Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. For the crown we wear there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it. Bear it for truth. Bear it for justice, and bear it for peace. Let us go out this morning with that determination. And I have not lost faith. I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. Because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. With this faith, we'll sing it as we are getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And this is the birth date of the Honorable Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. This program, African Perspectives, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Also on Mondays, Acres of Diamonds, Public Affairs Programming, every Monday from 6 to 8, Brother Wahad. Let's Buy Black 365 from 8 to 9, and then Conversation Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey from 9 to 10. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10. On Wednesdays, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10. On Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy at 7 p.m. If it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, you know that's right. It is time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Fridays at 8 p.m. On Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Revive with Sister POC. And then Sunday night, once again, it's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Every Monday through Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m., it's the Warren Ballantyne Show right here on Time for an Awakening Media. And the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Welcome back again, brothers and sisters. Appreciate you listening and being here on this birth date of the Honorable Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, a brother who I believe was evolving to understand. In fact, I keep hearing the words of Dr. King to why is the brother's name escaping me? he said to the brother, he said, I believe that I'm trying to integrate my people into a burning building. You know? And I can see the brother's face. Why is sometimes this happens, you know, to as we get a little older, we have these little brain farts and so forth, and people, Harry Belafonte, people who you know, people whose face and name are recognizable and immediate, until suddenly, like, why can't I conjure up this brother's name? Harry Belafonte, he said that to Harry Belafonte, he said, I believe I'm trying to integrate my people into a burning building. He was correct. And the quotes that I have before me, there's a few quotes here I'm going to definitely make, because there's some that are very profound and some that I really, you know, I've really over time begun to appreciate Dr. King. Yes, as I stated earlier, when he passed April 4th, 1968, when he was assassinated, when he was murdered by this government, you know, I was already starting into a mind frame. I was in high school, starting into a mind frame of, you know, being more radical. You know, the Republic of New Africa coming into existence, the Black Panther Party coming into existence, the radicalism, even though he had passed in 1965, you know, February 21st, 1965, you know, Malcolm X, and how I grabbed, because that was one of the first books I read, was the autobiography of Malcolm X. Till the first book I read was Soul on Ice, Eldridge Cleaver. Man, I'll say. We have a caller, 225-225. Good afternoon. 225. Well, let me do this. How about that? 225, good afternoon.
Yes, is it afternoon or is it morning?
Well, oh, yeah, that's I'm right. On the, that's right.
I'm
you're
in
on
Central Time.
You're on. So it's morning to you, okay. Dear brother. All right.
Yes. Good morning or afternoon, Ocean.
I'm doing fine, Brother Pugh. How are you doing?
Pretty good. You know, I was noticing you were talking about, you know, being woke back in 68. Unfortunately, I wasn't woke at that time. It took me a couple of decades to wake up. But I respected the folks that were woke.
Exactly. So. And that's the thing, all in time. And, you know, I always like to make this, you know, because, I mean, even though I was awakened back then and probably one of the main persons, I don't know if you remember Virginia Grant. Virginia Grant Stamper.
Yes, Virginia Grant Stamper, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. she is truly instrumental in my conscious raising. She had a program in Milwaukee on right across the street from Mount Zion Church over on 2nd and Garfield. There was a Lutheran church, an old Lutheran church there. And from that church, there was a building behind, house behind it. We had, they had, she had a program called Learn Power. And it was directed mm-hmm. to the, it was directed to the young children in that community there, where they can come there, get a meal, and learn about their history. And I was one of the students that helped with that learning, you know. And that's where, because honestly, Brother Pugh, you know, we didn't get back in the school then, and we marched out of school across the city of Milwaukee for Black history to be taught in our schools. But prior to that, we didn't get that. Only thing we probably got was Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver. You didn't even get Frederick Douglass, because they didn't want you to know anybody about who resisted, anybody about who took the whip from the Caucasian and started whipping his ass. They didn't want you to know anything about that. You know, you definitely weren't going to get no Nat Turner. You know, you might have got, we didn't even learn about Harriet Tubman, you know. So, you know, in that program, I learned so much. I learned the Black National Anthem. I learned about Marcus Garvey. I learned so much, you know, and that was really instrumental in my conscious raising, you know, when that program, being a part of that program for 2 summers. So it was outstanding. And I got paid, too. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, because my experience is completely different, I was I was an intellectual, but I was anti-school, and so I really had,
Yeah, that's how I remember you too. That's how I remember you too, Brother Pugh. Yeah, yeah, as an intellectual, that's right.
I mean, you know, but one of the things I do is I really appreciate the folks, you know, who are woke, who are young and aware, and so on, and it's just clear to me just how valuable that is.
I agree.
And how easy it is to basically derail our children by, turning them into these, wasted directions. So,
yeah. Oh, no doubt. That's encouraging. I know when I was going to the Black Men Think Tank in Cincinnati back in the 90s, you know, because it coincided with the Cincinnati American African Firefighter and Police organizations that had a King celebration, you know, they had a nice dinner dance. And so some of our brothers, when I was still in the fire department, we would travel. And of course I would go to the think tank, and I would still attend the dance, but my main thing was going to the think tank. Cause what they had in Cincinnati was a board meeting, and I wasn't on the board, so I didn't have to go. And then they would have the dinner dance that night. And this was for quite a few years. And so I had an opportunity to go to Cincinnati. Brother Dr. Eric Abercrombie would put on the Black Men's Think Tank. And what was encouraging to me was the number of young students who were involved. You know, that was so encouraging to me. And then, of course, he'd have some of the top scholars, at the time. I think the constants were Naeem Akbar, Malana Karinga. Who else was a constant? Well, there were so many others that they brought there, you know, Malefi Asante, mm-hmm. you know, Francis Cress Welsing.
Probably Cress Welsing, yeah. I was going to say that. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was, I mean, you know, I'm getting that information, that's just outstanding, man.
And probably even Hakim Adabudi.
Yes.
But, you know, the experience that awoke me was, I don't remember which year I saw it, but I saw Bill Cosby's film, Black History Lost,
yeah.
Stolen Astray.
Yes.
And, you know, the idea that my teacher may not know the truth, or my teacher may know the truth and be afraid to tell me or mm-hmm. not want to tell me.
Right.
That the books themselves may not have the truth in them, or the story may not be the whole story. In fact, my whole intellectual journey began with that, because I began to ask the question,
well, I need to develop a framework. I need to develop a way of knowing that's independent of biases and blindnesses that folks might have because of their backgrounds, right? Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, everything I've done, you know, today, what I have, I've developed a theory of everything, and it's based on the ideal of how can you know if I were in a situation where they had deprived me of the books, if I were in a situation where there were people systematically trying to brainwash me, how can I know what's true independent of that?
Right.
And so what I began to do is look for signs that are independent of things that human beings do that give you an indication of what's really going on. And so, but in any case, I really do appreciate when I see young people who,
yes, I do,
you know, are conversing. I'm thinking about, you know, I was reading, some time ago about, Ibram Kendi's book, Stamp from the Beginning, you know, mm-hmm. he's talking about Angela Davis, you know, and her upbringing. And I'm just so impressed that, you know, the things that she knew and the people that she was thinking about at a young age, and, mm-hmm. and Stokely Carmichael. So in other words, when I think about that, I'm inspired and you know, so I just, you know, I can't undo my past. But
right.
You know,
I'm hoping, you know, as I continue to, you know, do what I do and the things that I, places I go and so forth, that, you know, I see young people and particularly hear them, not just see them, but hear them in how they are talking about the future and how they're talking about a future independent of America. Because I think that the idea of an all-inclusive America, as Dr. King wanted us to believe in, and hope for and pray for and work towards, is a fallacy, is not real, because we're dealing with an entity that has the inability and does not even think about or care to be receptive of being inclusive with everybody else. That's why I say of all our studies, as Malcolm said, of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward our research. And if we look at the history of Europeans as it relates to people outside of them, it is not good. It is not good at all. They've imposed their culture on other people. They imposed their religion on other people. The whole damn world is, the majority of the world, you know what? I'm not a Muslim, but I'm glad Islam came on the scene to counteract Christianity. Then that's just it. I'm not a Muslim, but I'm glad there's something that challenges, even though there are some things about Islam and Christianity that are similar, because why? They're still Abrahamic religions. They still come from Abraham, which, of course, Abraham Jewish religion, and of course, because he is the father of all three religions, you know, so there's supposed to be that some of those connections there. But still, I feel that there is literally nothing we can do to change Caucasian. The only thing that could happen is something miraculously, is something divine. Some divine intervention. And I don't see it. I deal with the reality. And the reality is, there's no way in hell that these Caucasians are ever going to come to a understanding that they're part of a human family and should behave and act as such, as opposed to dominating and controlling every damn thing. That's my opinion. No, that ain't my damn opinion. Because I don't give you my opinion, Brother Pugh. Because my opinion is deeply profane. I give you the work of scholars and historians, our people, our warrior scholars and historians. So that's the perspective that I give you, you know? Yeah.
Well, one of the things, there are a couple of things that I can say. First of all, with respect to young people, what I do when I see people is I group them into three categories. Some people, they see the current reality as the best of all possible worlds.
Now, these people I see as criminals, and my job is to deconstruct them, to sort of slow their roll, slow them down. There's a second group of people, they see the current world as not the best of all possible worlds, but the only feasible world. I see these people as slaves or professionals. In other words, these are people who believe that they just have to you know, obey and submit. And so my objective for these people is to give them hope, to give them a sense that that they actually do have control, maybe not over everything and maybe not over the most important things, but they do have control. And it turns out, even if all you have is a penny's worth of control, that penny can become a dime over time, et cetera, et cetera. And then the third group are people who I see, and they see the current world as not the best possible world and not the only feasible world, but rather a suboptimal world. And so my challenge for them is I imagine them having two or three tools that they're using to advance their agenda. And what I'd like to do is to give them at least one more tool, you know, to add, you know, to their agenda. So that's my sense of young people. Now, with respect to Dr. King, he talked about the beloved community. And what I do is I take that to another level, and I talk about the sacred world. You know, when he talked about, you know, his talk with Belafonte about, you know, we're integrating into a burning house, and that therefore what we really need is a transformation of the values of this society away from militarism, racism, and materialism. What I do when I talk about the sacred world is I recognize that, in fact, you saw it when on the night that Martin Luther King died, that his value system was based on, you know, his European education, mm-hmm. that he was quoting Euripides and, you know, Socrates now,
yeah.
as opposed to, you know, his people and his ancestors.
Exactly.
Right? So one of the things I do in the sacred world model is I say that instead of us being individuals, we begin as persons and families. And so every one of us is a part of a family. We're not just some, you know, individuals independent of that. The second thing is that these people and families, these families are part of communities. The third dimension is that these communities are part of societies. And then the fourth dimension is that these societies are part of ecologies. So, for example, there's a society of ants, there's a society of human beings, et cetera. There are communities of black people, there are communities of Asian people, et cetera, et cetera. And so in the sacred world model, you recognize that, in fact, I remember Cornel West came to UWM one year, and he was explaining something, and, you know, I asked him the question. I said, well, Dr. West, you give the impression that the only thing that has to happen is that the people, that we human beings have to agree, whereas it seems to me that I don't hear nature in your model anywhere. And one of the things with the, you know, the Christian notion of supernaturalism suggests that you don't have to pay attention to nature, that, in other words, there's some other set of laws that are independent of nature, and you get with them. There's some personal relationship you can have with the creator of the universe, and he'll intervene for you. So that's the second piece. Now, the third piece with respect to your pessimism, well, one of the things that I do is that when I look at history, I see the transformations of white people. And by the way, I differentiate European peoples from white people. White
really?
People are the criminal class. And all European peoples are not white. For example, if you look at Haiti,
hold on, because all Europeans, even though you just said what you said, and they wouldn't classify themselves as white, they would classify themselves as white. If they're Europeans are so damn arrogant that they made Europe a continent. Europe is not a continent by anybody's definition, and strictly by the definitions that they put in a damn book called Webster. It doesn't fit, because they wanted to develop an idea of collective whiteness. and they call themselves that. Europeans
yes,
call
right. But yes, and by the way, Nell Painter in her book, I believe it's called The Invention of Whiteness or and mm-hmm. so on, you know, she talks about that. But right, that was their whole vision. In fact, that was one of the reasons for the contrast with the African, is that what they had is they had feudalism. They had white people
right.
who were basically slaves.
Right.
They were property. And so the vision of coming to America, the idea was, how can, when we release these white people from our control, how can we act? How can we get them to act the way we want them to act? In other words, what we want to do, what the Americans wanted to do, was to create an empire. But they had Europeans who had come over here and who had been feudal serfs. And so the minute that they were no longer, you know, under the rule of a master or a lord, they would have a subsistence economy. And the problem is, people like Hamilton were saying, well, look, a subsistence economy, we can never become great with that. And so what they did is they began to imagine that, look, what we're going to do is we're going to contrast, we're going to basically brainwash Europeans to sort of differentiate themselves from, say, African people. And we're going to define them as the primitives and doing all this subsistence stuff that we don't want people to do. And we're going to say that, no, you're different than that. And one of the manifestations of your difference, in fact, that's what Protestantism was all about, that, you know, the more stuff you got, you know, the closer you are to God and so on. Right. So what I'm saying is that when you look at their story, when you look at their history, you can see transformations of the value system of white people as a function of what they thought they needed to do. You see that with African people today, where African people are, you know, imagining what the future is going to be like and asking themselves what it is they need to learn in order, you know, to deal with the future. In fact, I'm reading a book right now about the first black at IBM, and his father was always talking about the importance of computers and why you need to learn them and so on. So I'm saying that once you begin to see the ideology, the origins of the transformations of the European, you'll begin to say, oh, okay, I can see where that happened. It's sort of like looking at a youth and seeing he's a juvenile delinquent, and then instead of saying, oh, we just need to throw this person away, he's just absolutely no good, look at these bad things he's done, understanding what the origin of those things that he done did were, and then begin to work backwards and say, okay, well, then these are some things that can be done. So what I'm suggesting to you is that, and I'll just give you one little concrete example. One of the, you know, the Romans were so obsessed with proving themselves superior to other animals that they had a strategy of not eating when they were hungry and not eating till they were full, because they said that's what animals do. Well, that's a mentality. And so, and one of the things that we're seeing today in 2020 is that the frameworks that Europeans had that essentially animated them, I would argue, for the last 2,500 years, because my analysis my critique of the Europeans begins with Plato, that's being deconstructed. And increasingly, they're beginning to realize that the way to be in the world is the way our ancestors were in the world. And once that begins to happen, then rather than having this handful of criminals, you know, attempting to, I don't know, control the universe, you'll all of a sudden begin to see a movement away from that toward something else. So, my vision.
I look at it, my personal project. I look at it through the eyes of the Honorable Sheikh Anta Diop and other African historians as they looked at European. And of course, my favorite book is Urugu, an African-centered critique of European cultural thought and behavior. Dr. Marimba Ani, my good friend. That book to me is the Bible, because it just doesn't look at the Europeans from an African perspective. It also looks at Europeans of how they thought about themselves and the things they've done. I look at Europeans, as Dr. Diop said, of the two cradle theory of human development. The one in the northern cradle in the icebox that is now called Europe, and the one in the southern cradle, the motherland of Africa, and how there was a complementarity between men and women, how there was a development of growth and development, how there was a love for themselves and others, how there was no fear. There was no fear. There was a xenophilia, no fear of people outside of themselves, you know, and what they needed, they had, as opposed to that icebox where things were scarce, where the attitude of European men, hardcore patriarchal, dominating, and the women had to acquiesce because it's cold. It's things are scarce. It's dark out there. There's animals out there. So she took the abuse, and like she still takes the abuse today, and how she is still relegated as a less than a human being as far as Europeans are concerned, because Europeans are hardcore male dominating. And that mindset continued on. And then, of course, the development of the Greeks and their mindset about how Greek are. There's a brother, I don't know if you remember when you were in Milwaukee, a brother who was a IFA educator and so forth, Brother Nanahochi. He moved here, here to Atlanta.
No, and I then don't he, remember him.
Okay, he moved here and he transitioned here. But prior to moving here, his wife, there was a naming ceremony, and she gave me my name. In fact, when she made her transition, I was at the firehouse, and I told her, I called the chief. I said, I was the captain. I said, hey, I'm going to put somebody in for me. I got to go do this. I had to go pay respects to her for giving me my name. But what Brother Nanahochi had said, he said, I have studied African cultures, multiple cultures in Africa, and nowhere have I found homosexuality as a practice in African culture. You can't find reliefs of Medu Netcher, or what the Greeks called hieroglyphs, in Kemet, or what they called Egypt, of homosexual behavior. You find a man and a woman. That's in Greece. Greek perpetuated that. In fact, they were such lovers of themselves that they turned the women off. The women went to the island of Lesbos. I remember that coming into the news about 3 or 4 years ago when there were a mass amount of migration into Europe, a lot of it being welcomed, particularly from Syria, because they don't look African. You know, it was welcome because the populations in Europe are dwindling and they needed workers, cheap laborers and so forth, particularly in Germany and Austria and so forth. You see? And so, you know, I look at that and I look at the Europeans' development after the Greeks and then the Romans, that who you had mentioned, they go into a dark age, a medieval age. The only knowledge and information that was happening in Europe was in the western part, in Spain and Portugal, with the advent of the Moors, those Muslim brothers that marched through northern Africa into the Iberian Peninsula and so forth, and they gave the Europeans a lot of information for over 700 years. 700 years until the Europeans once again had their awakening with Martel and Charlemagne and some others, you know, and then they developed this idea of their so-called Renaissance. In fact, you know, I'm a lover of history myself, Brother Pugh, and one of the first things I remember when I was a kid, probably back in middle school, was learning about the Renaissance of Man, as it was titled. You know, it wasn't, and I didn't know no damn better. I'm just learning. I didn't know that the Renaissance of Man was not the Renaissance of Man. It was the awakening of white folks, awakening up Europeans. It wasn't humanity, right, but because of their arrogance and because of how they are men. Everybody else ain't. And we shown the hell wasn't. So then they come out of that, and then they venture out. Marco Polo, an Italian. Marco Polo goes to China. He comes back with pasta. The people think that pasta, spaghetti, is Italian. But no, it is Chinese. That's like people think that rice is Chinese. But no, it is African. But when he came back, that was more important for the European expansion was fireworks, gunpowder, which Chinese use for celebration. But with the European, it was developed superior weaponry. I always say this, Brother Pugh. One thing about the European, he's always found a better way to kill your ass to this very day. From way back when he could just throw a rock at you or hit you with a club or a spear or a crossbow or a knife, whatever, to the Gatling gun, and I could go on. He's always found a better way to kill you. Or go look at the Inquisitions, all the crazy stuff that he created with the evil mind of torture. You know? So the let me finish this point.
Okay.
It is from that point that the European now goes out and takes everybody's stuff in the name of. And what they've noticed in taking everybody's stuff, the females they encountered through rape, by raping these women, the offspring did not look like them, which is Dr. Frances Cress Welsing's, that she said she was in her kitchen, had an epiphany, and said, this is the deal. They saw that, and it caused an innate fear in them of genetic annihilation to the point that we must control this. We must be, even though we're not dominant in numbers. The only place they were dominant in numbers is United States for a number of reasons. Pretty soon, they will not be. In fact, just 10 to 15 years from this point, this day, they will be a minority in this country. In fact, I just read something that said the babies, that all of the babies that are being born now, that babies of color outnumber Caucasian babies. So the fear that is there, I remember years ago, the first time I heard about the demographers having a plan was through Minister Louis Farrakhan. He said the demographers predict by the year 2050 that the European will be a minority in this country. Well, at that time, they were experiencing zero population growth. For everyone that is born, another dies, and so forth. That's what we are experiencing here in America. But for Europeans globally, in Europe, in Australia, wherever, they're experiencing negative population growth. For everyone that is born, two die. And so as a consequence, they must maintain this dominance and control. And so, far as I'm concerned, Brother Pugh, the European truly does, as Franz Fanon said, they suffer from cognitive dissonance. They believe that they're superior. Everything they do and how they act is in that vein. And even though there's a plethora of information to prove otherwise, they dismiss it, they ignore it, because it does not fit with their narrative. They suffer from. So there's not a damn thing that we as African people or even the damn world can do to prove otherwise. They also suffer from what Dr. D'Angelo, who coined the phrase white fragility. They suffer. They are fragile. They don't want to hear because they believe that they are good Christian people. They believe that what they have done was good for the world. Yes, okay, I put you in slavery. Yes, but really you are better off. And it was a good thing for the world. They suffer from fragility. They don't want to hear it. Hey, they don't want to hear from white folks. You know, they shown in hell don't want to hear from us. And also, hegemony. The European has the idea that what is mine is mine, and what is yours is mine. So when you tally all that up, there ain't a damn thing that we can do and we shown in hell can't do nothing militarily. Oh, yeah, we can get into a boxing ring and kick their ass. We've always kicked their ass physically, but we really have kicked their ass mentally. But because of the only areas they will allow you to go through, then we, of course, put energy into those areas. But if we were in a society, Brother Pugh, that valued humanity regardless of who it was, and you had the ability to ascend to whatever high ranking or high level of attainment and knowledge and so forth, once again, we would kick their ass. But that's the situation that we are in. And to me, what young people must understand, there ain't no way, no hope that we can appeal to these folks to do right, act right, and be right. We have to begin to develop Pan-Africanism. It's either Pan-Africanism or we perish. It's either we unite or we die. Unify or die. That's the T-shirt. You remember that Pew, don't you? When I don't know if it was Puff Daddy, whoever, vote or die, back when Barack was running in 08.
No, but I can imagine that being one. Yes.
Yeah, you know, when it pushed for voting and so forth.
Even though Pan-Africanism is not incompatible with what I'm talking about, because Pan-Africanism, that's a society. But you have to, in other words, for you to exist in this world, you have to coexist with other creatures. And so you have your society, they have their society. In other words, to live on this world, the metaphor that I use is a circle. Every circle has two properties. First of all, it has limits, meaning that every circle has this finite distance from the center of it, you know, to the circumference, and that difference is the same. That's called a limit. And the second thing that every circle has is that it's periodic, meaning that if you start at one part on the circle, eventually you'll get back to that same part.
Exactly.
Well, periodicity and limits, that enables you to coexist with other people. If all you had were limits, that's necessary, but that's not sufficient, because your limits may be, for example, you may have a limit that all you eat is three rabbits, but there may only be three rabbits in existence. And so if you just ate the three rabbits according to your limit, you would annihilate all rabbits. And since your existence depends upon rabbits, ultimately you would preclude your own existence. Well, what periodicity does is that the rabbit begins to see that you're hunting, and he begins to make himself scarce. So even though you went out to get three rabbits, you only caught one rabbit. You killed that and ate that. Well, the fact that those other two survived, that meant that your people could survive. So that's the first thing. But now the second fundamental principle, that remember what I said, that I recognized how easy it is for people to be bamboozled and miseducated. And so I asked for some frameworks that are unassailable, unambiguous ways to understand what's going on in the world. And one of the first things I did is, you know, in philosophy, they call it Occam's razor, where I'm saying, well, what are the minimum number of assumptions that I need to make? And so I say, well, now, if I start off assuming that somebody, I can start off assuming somebody is different than me or somebody is like me. And if I assume that they're like me, then what has to happen in order for me to do what they did, right? And so that takes you to Maya Angelou when she says, nothing that's human is alien from me. In other words, what human beings do, I can see how I can do it. And in fact, one of the easy ways you can see is that, you know, as a human, you make decisions either based upon what's in your mind, which is logical, or what's in your heart, which is intuitive. Well, the problem with things that are in your mind, it's very possible for you to ignore what's happening in the world when you're paying attention to your mind. And so as a result, you know, you can do any number of things. But let me give you one more concrete example of this sort of normalization of behavior that you see as pathological. You made the observation that that these people are oblivious to evidence, that they imagine themselves superior, and no evidence can gainsay that. Well, the similar thing to, you know, Richard Pryor says, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes, right? Well, we're on a daily basis, you can hear black people talking to other black people about the fact that they've internalized their own inferiority. And despite the proof of superiority, in fact, I mentioned last night on Dr. Rogers' program, but I didn't elaborate the whole story, but I'll just mention it just briefly. In the case of these, the Nigerian people, they were trying to get a World Bank loan to do some irrigation, and they had a multi-thousand-year-old irrigation strategy that produced 500 bushels of sorghum per hectare. And they were negotiating with the World Bank to get a strategy that would only produce 11 bushels per hectare.
And the reason that there was even a discussion is because there was an assumption that white people and what white technologies and whatnot are superior to black people and black technologies, which is, you know, completely bogus. But there's one other point that I'd like to make. You know, you talked about gunpowder and the fact that the European, you know, finds a way, you know, to essentially destroy life. Well, I would argue that that's part of a paradigm, and I can show that that's not peculiar to Europeans. That's peculiar to white people. That is to say, the subset of Europeans who imagine themselves, you know, leading their people, you know, to some better place in the world. But one of the things I'm reading, I told you I was reading this guy, the first black that called Frank Black, the first black who was a systems engineer at IBM, and he's talking about the origin of computers. And of course, you know, my analysis shows that technology itself is inherently criminal, and it leads to, you know, all kinds of negative. In fact, it's anti-life.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I've been saying that for quite a while, because when you look at artificial intelligence, when you look at all the different technologies, when you go shopping, do you go to the kiosk and check out your food? Do you do that? I sure in the hell don't do that. Because right. I go to the cashier. I don't give a damn if I got to wait in line 15, 20 minutes. I'm going to the cashier. The only place I go to the kiosk now is at Southwest Airlines, because I got to go there. Because that's how you get your ticket. You know?
Oh, you know, this guy, Clyde Ford, and this Frank Black, he has a chapter on that.
It's going to eliminate jobs.
Let me. In other words, what he does is this is a rich point I'm trying to make here. Let me see if I can make this.
Yeah, because you know my time is up. My time is up. Go ahead and make that point.
Okay. Well, what he does, you would like Frank Black, because what he does is he looks at technology and he shows how technology has certainly been antithetical to black life. And he goes and elaborates that. But one of his confusions is that if you read Ibrahim Kendi, his Stamp from the Beginning, what he does is he shows that from the beginning of America, there have been multiple streams, that it hasn't been one stream, there have been one group who were trying to impose their superiority. There was another group who were assuming we were inferior, and then there was a third group who believed that we were as capable as anybody else. And so rather than one stream, there have been three streams, but what happens is that people blend these streams and think they're only one thing, and then they're confused thinking that, you know, we've overcome, and then surprised that, you know, it seems something is still there. Well, because those streams are there, and so right. You have to look at those in separate. In any case, this has been rich.
Yeah, well, listen, I really, really appreciate you, Brother Pugh. I've run up on the clock. In fact, I'm past, but I want to at least get this quote in, which is one of my favorite Dr. King quotes. And I mean, because, you know, I'm on a page of quotes, and so there's multiple quotes. But this one has struck me the most when I was, you know, looking at this. And he says, "There's nothing in all the world more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity." That's a quote that a lot of us, I know, I'm hip. You got to laugh because it's real. It's just, hey, Brother Pugh, it's just like brother on the street. So the reporter is trying to get a question asked from the brother on the street. "Excuse me, sir. Yeah. What do you think adversely affects the black community the most? Is it ignorance or apathy?" Brother on the street compounds the question. He scratches his head, scratches his ass. He said, "You know what? I don't know, and I don't care." That's it. And so to be sincere, because you know what the word sincere means, it's dedicated to being ignorant. Now, ignorance, of course, in itself is not bad, because ignorance is absence of knowledge. Now, you know, many times I've had conversations with you, some of the things that you have thrown at me were, I was absent of that knowledge. But it's easy to impart new knowledge, to to end your ignorance. I'm ignorant of quantum physics, but if somebody explained quantum physics to me, then that would end that ignorance. So I'm not sincere and dedicated to ignorance. But then he says, conscientious stupidity, to be conscious, aware that your ass is stupid. And the things that you believe and things that you do, to me.
Well, he means conscientious, meaning that you're going out your way to stay ignorant.
Exactly.
I don't know,
you're going out your way to stay.
And I don't need to know.
That's right.
It's like what the Senate is doing now,
right,
with respect to the impeachment here. I don't need no facts.
That's right.
And I don't need no witnesses.
I hope that all of those people, all those Republicans, are just as culpable to this I don't know. Let me say this. I gotta go, dear brother. I appreciate the time. Appreciate your call. Call again.
Well, the key thing is humility. It's humility. The opposite of humility is being a gangster, having 9 cents worth of information and thinking you have 10 cents worth. But humility is the recognition that your island of knowledge is surrounded by a sea of ignorance.
That's right. All right, dear brother. We end this program like we end this program like all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E. Because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in the hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, once again, I thank you. Enjoy this day. Enjoy the rest of the week. Enjoy next week, Monday, which is the King Day, official King. No, that ain't official. It's just a holiday off thing. You know, enjoy this weekend. Be before you. Brothers and sisters, Shemhotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahodia means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we shall be victorious. You have a blessed and wonderful day. Peace, family.